As of 2012, the National Cancer Institute estimates that nearly 14 million Americans are living with a history of cancer. Some of these persons have cancer and are undergoing treatment today, but many people are now cancer-free. 1.7 million cases of cancer are expected to occur this year. Nearly 600,000 people will die as a result of cancer, as it is the number two cause of death. That means that one out of every four deaths occurring is a result of cancer. This means that although we have made good progress in advancing cancer diagnosis and treatment, there is much work to be done. Good evening, I'm Dr. Randy Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. For the next hour, we will be discussing updates in cancer diagnosis and treatment. We are fortunate to have with us tonight three experts who will answer your questions. We have with us tonight Dr. Anil Velivalu. Dr. Velivalu is a medical oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. We also have with us tonight Dr. Destin Black. Dr. Black is a gynecological surgical oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center and University Health. Dr. Velivalu, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
When we talk about cancer treatment, typically we think of radiation therapy, chemotherapy, as well as surgery. And these are pretty scary facets of medical treatment in general. What is chemotherapy? And as a medical oncologist, what is your role in determining whether a patient actually needs chemotherapy?
Well, there are many factors that go into that decision process. The paradigm of chemotherapy or cancer treatment has been changing over the last 10 or 15 years. And this is due to advancing technology in the field. Chemotherapy historically is meant to destroy rapidly dividing cells or cancer cells predominantly, but the side effects associated with it are due to the effect of that chemo on other rapidly dividing cells in the body, may it be the gut, the hair follicles, whatnot. The new paradigm is shifting towards targeted treatments, immunomodulation, utilizing the patient's own immune system as well to target and treat their own cancers. So the tolerability of chemotherapy per se is changing and much improved. I was speaking with a patient of mine just yesterday, and he was asking me after having received chemotherapy for 1 week, when's he going to get sick? And that was really nice to hear. There's a lot of fear, as you mentioned, associated with receiving treatment for cancer, may it be surgery or post-operative chemotherapy or radiation therapy if it's needed. And this is frequently dependent upon the stage of the disease after diagnosis and workup. I can't make a blanket statement as to what the decision to make or give someone chemotherapy would be, but it's individualized, of course.
Certainly an individualized plan is what we are all certainly looking for. Dr. Black, we now have very good information about surveillance and prevention of many cancers, especially gynecological ones. What is an update with regards to the surveillance and prevention of some of the gynecological cancers that we encounter?
Well, the three most common gynecologic cancers that we encounter are endometrial cancer, cervical cancer, and ovarian cancer. And the biggest advances out of these three in terms of prevention, I would say, would have to be on the front of cervical cancer. And that really has to do with the vaccine that targets the human papillomavirus. The human papillomavirus is thought to be responsible for essentially 100% of all cervical cancer cases. And unfortunately, too many women are not receiving this vaccine. This is a vaccine that can be given to as young as the age of 9. It's generally recommended for around the age of 11 to 13. So if this vaccine is actually given and the patients that do receive it, it's thought to be very effective in actually preventing the development of cervical cancer. Ovarian cancer, on the other hand, the biggest struggle that we have with ovarian cancer is actually early detection. Many people think that a pap smear detects ovarian cancer, so they go to their doctor every year, they get their pap smear, and then when they're diagnosed, if they're diagnosed with ovarian cancer, they're very shocked and upset because they've been seeing their doctor every year. But unfortunately, we do not have a screening tool for ovarian cancer. And there's a lot of research being done in this area, but up at this time, we don't have a screening tool. And endometrial cancer, it is the most common cancer that I see. There are over 40,000 new cases a year. Fortunately, most of the time we detected it very early stage. Usually it's stage one and it's very treatable. And the reason for that is women usually will have symptoms, and usually these women will present with bleeding. So anytime we have a patient, somebody who presents with bleeding after they've gone through the change of life, menopause, then it's very important that they see their doctor right away.
Thank you very much. We also have with us tonight Dr. Sanford Katz, a radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Welcome, Dr. Katz.
Thank you.
What are the updates, in your opinion, that are most important regarding radiation treatment for cancer?
Well, much like chemotherapy treats the whole body, and recent advances really are based upon targeting the cancer cells. Same is true with the latest radiation advances. That is, we're really looking to localize the radiation delivery to the tumor and minimize the dose to the surrounding critical structures, the healthy tissues. And radiation, unlike chemotherapy, is basically packets of energy. And so we deliver that energy using machines typically and target that into the body. And probably the advances in imaging using CAT scans and biologic scans like PET scans enable us to better see where the cancers are to a greater degree than we've ever been able to before. And we also use the imaging to plan the radiation so that we're able to customize the radiation beams directly to the tumor and minimize the dose to the healthy organs. That's really been the limiting factor in the treatment of tumors with radiation. You know, we can give very high doses of radiation to tumors. The problem is we potentially can damage healthy structures and do more harm than good. So much like a knife, you know, it can cure in skilled hands if it's placed in the right places. It's when that tool ends up damaging healthy tissues, it's when you get the side effects. So radiation today in various forms is now more selective.
Thank you, Dr. Katz. As always, we welcome your calls. Please call us at 1-800-552-8502. We are discussing cancer diagnosis and treatment on Health Matters on Red River Radio. We have three expert panelists tonight. We have Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist. We have Dr. Anil Velavalu, medical oncologist. We have Dr. Destin Black, surgical gynecologic oncologist. Dr. Black, you mentioned HPV is responsible for nearly all cervical cancers. How does one detect HPV at its earliest stage? Is it symptomatic, for
actually,
example?
Actually, most women, they say the studies show that 90% of women have been exposed to the virus at some point in their life. By the time they turn 40, 90% of people have been exposed. The thing is, most of the time, this infection is a transient infection. When the virus persists, then you have that possibility of developing cancer and also precancerous lesions. So when you actually go in to see your physician and have that pap smear, we also can test you for the human papillomavirus. And that's something that's newer. We're actually the guidelines have recently changed to incorporate testing with the human papillomavirus at the time of your pap smear. And the goal of that is to actually detect the cancer at its earliest stage in the pre-cancer form, where it's much easier to treat. Once you've developed the cancer, then it becomes more difficult to treat, although it is treatable, especially in the early stages.
Okay, thank you very much. You mentioned that girls as young as 9 to 13 can get the HPV vaccine. Many of these girls will not have had a pap smear yet. So how do they go about getting a vaccination? Is this available through their pediatrician,
yes.
Okay. Very good. And what age would you recommend that girls get their first pap smear?
Well, actually, the pap smear recommendation has recently changed. We used to recommend after intercourse, within 3 years after intercourse, but now the recommendation has changed to the age of 21. And I think that the important thing here is that girls are getting that initial pap smear, but they're also being offered the vaccine, which is actually a series of three shots.
So if a girl has not had the vaccine and she has a pap smear and it's normal, is it guaranteed that she has not contracted HPV at that point if she hasn't had the HPV test? And is it okay for her to go ahead and be vaccinated at that point?
Yeah, it's actually the vaccine is actually approved up to the age of 26. And so if she's not had the vaccine, and I hope I'm answering your question properly, but if she has not had the vaccine and she sees her physician, she's getting her first pap smear, she can definitely get the vaccine. And you can actually have the vaccine even after you've been exposed to the human papillomavirus. And it still is effective, just not as effective as if you've had the vaccine prior to exposure.
How effective is the vaccine?
It's the studies have shown that if you receive the vaccine before exposure, it's close to 100% effective against cervical cancer.
So I understand there are a number of types of HPV virus in terms of numbering and genotypes. Is the vaccine designed to prevent specifically the types that are carcinogenic, or does it prevent
Yes.
the types, for example, that cause genital warts?
It actually targets both. It targets the cancer as well as genital warts.
And you mentioned within 3 years of intercourse, so presumably this is a sexually transmitted disease.
It is considered a sexually transmitted disease. Like I said, though, most people, by the time 90% of women by the time they turn 40 have been exposed at some point in their life.
And you mentioned that most cases of the virus infection are cleared. Apparently, when women get the virus, it's transmitted by their partner. Can partners be tested if a woman tests positive for the HPV virus or she has carcinogenic lesions on the cervix?
Currently, the male, we don't routinely test the male males for the human papillomavirus.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Velavalu, what is the most common cancer that you treat?
I have a particular sub-interest in GI malignancies, hepatobiliary malignancies, so esophageal, stomach, colon, pancreas, liver, gallbladder.
And looking over the most recent cancer data, it looks like the mortality rate from pancreatic cancer has remained stable over many, many years, and it's not really changing. Unfortunately, the prognosis is not great. Liver cancer, it seems to be the same story. But however, colon cancer, we've made tremendous progress. Has it been that we've made so much progress in colon cancer, yet we're still failing to make the same amount of progress in liver and pancreas?
Well, actually, Dr. Brewer, in the last several years, we've come up with new medication in the management of hepatocellular carcinoma, which is a primary liver malignancy. That is predisposed to people with chronic hepatitis or cirrhosis. Prior to approximately two and a half years ago, there was no medication, no chemotherapy available that would treat that malignancy. The only treatment was surgical resection or transplant. There was a medication that was approved that improves time to disease progression. It's an oral medication, of all things. It's targeted at the cancer cell specifically. That's for liver cancer. Pancreatic cancer, in the last several years also, we've made some significant discoveries in the sense for stage 4 pancreas cancer. There are two particular regimens that have been discovered that may, in fact, prolong survival in stage 4 pancreas cancer. I've had the opportunity to use both of these regimens, and I've seen the clinical results with patients living, much beyond the previous median survival of 6 months that was given to them in times past for stage 4 pancreatic cancer. My patient's 1-2 years out now with diagnosis of metastatic pancreas cancer if they're given these regimens. Now, some of the discoveries in colon cancer, particularly metastatic colon cancer, have come throughout the last 10 years, and these have all been aimed at targeting specific points of cellular metabolism in the colon cancer, and that's those discoveries have led to improved survival seen in advanced colon cancer. Unfortunately, we don't have any data to support any definitive benefit in the lower stage colon cancer, stage 1 and 2, with any chemotherapy or radiation therapy given after surgical resection of those diseases. Stage 3, we still have known benefit of giving chemotherapy after surgical resection and improving recurrence rate and survival at this point.
Thank you very much, Dr. Velivalu. We have a caller, and I remind you to call us at 1-800-552-8502. Larry from Shreveport, thanks for joining us tonight. What's your question?
Yes, I was concerned. I was reading a little while ago an article about the use of nanotechnology in medicine and wondering where, how does nanotechnology work and how could this be adapted for the use in cancer treatment?
Nanotechnology. Dr. Katz, you're the most technologically savvy physician that we have on the panel at the current moment. What do you see as nanotechnology in the future of cancer diagnosis and treatment?
I'm the most technologically advanced. Well, you know, that I will admit that's a little outside my scope. You know, that's still not in really widely in clinical use. It's still an area of development and experimentation, whereby very, very small molecules are used to target cancer cells. And, you know, it's really not something that's widely available, and it's certainly not something that that I have experience in my practice. I do use subatomic particles to treat cancers, and the most exciting of which is proton therapy, which we're fortunate to be developing and should have available by the end of this year here in Shreveport at Willis-Knighton. But that's different than nanotechnology. So I can speak a little bit about particle therapy, but I'm going to have to pass on the nanotechnology question. I'm sorry.
So in terms of proton therapy, what is a proton and how does that differ from an X-ray particle?
Yeah, so traditional radiation therapy uses X-rays, and those are typically produced by machines. And much like a photon of light, a particle of light, it's very similar to the X-rays that people receive when they have a chest X-ray or they have a dental X-ray. That is, basically, energetic particles go through the body, and whatever they interact with along their path can result in damage. So, in the case of using photons to treat cancers, we use those traditionally in most cases to treat tumors, solid tumors, that is. And the disadvantages is that just like if you had imaging, those photons, those X-rays, go right through the body. And so they don't stop at the tumor. They continue along their path, and they end up interacting with healthy tissues. The proton therapy, or the protons, is actually a subatomic particle. It's a charged particle. It has some mass, though it's very, very small, and it's produced by a cyclotron. So it's a totally different type of radiation. And what we do is we use these to treat tumors as well. But the advantage of the proton is that it doesn't go through the body necessarily. In fact, it has a very unique characteristic whereby it travels kind of through the body without interacting. It's so small that it just continues along its path, not interacting with any of the other particles or molecules until it loses its energy, and then it basically stops, and it delivers all of its energy at a point. So you get very little entrance dose, and you get virtually no exit dose. And so you're able to then modify that into a kind of a spread, and so you literally can deliver the radiation at the tumor's doorstep, right through to the back door, and then stop. And it really represents probably the most exciting and most precise form of radiation available.
How does this compare to what has traditionally been discussed as tomotherapy, which is very focally administered radiation therapy? And how would you determine which patient needs tomotherapy versus a patient that may need a proton beam approach?
Yeah, we're also fortunate. We had the third tomotherapy machine in the world here in Shreveport. I have a lot of experience with that, and it's a phenomenal machine. And basically what that machine does is it uses the photons, the X-rays, but it delivers it from 360 degrees. So basically, if you think of it in terms of the spokes on a wagon wheel, with a little bit of radiation coming in from each angle and where they converge in the center, you get your highest dose. That's tomotherapy. But it also, what makes it that machine unique is it couples a CAT scanner with a radiation delivery system. So it takes a CAT scan every day before treatment to verify exactly what you're treating, and then it kind of delivers the radiation in reverse. So it really is the most conformal of the X-ray delivery systems. The proton therapy is just kind of like the next generation, where it's that much better than tomotherapy. Although there are certain situations where tomotherapy might be more advantageous than protons, depending upon the situation.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Vellavallo, you mentioned some advances in hepatobiliary cancer, and we know that risk factors for hepatic cancer, like cervical cancer, include viral infection, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, for example, patients who are obese, patients who have alcohol consumption. And since we have advances in the treatment of that cancer now, what are we doing in terms of surveillance in high-risk populations?
High-risk populations, those, as you mentioned, with chronic hepatitis or alcoholic cirrhosis or cirrhosis in general due to other less common etiologies, are usually followed by a GI physician, a hepatologist. Surveillance includes a laboratory every 3 to 6 months, as well as CT scans of the liver versus ultrasound, alternating with ultrasounds of the liver to monitor for any tumor development. There is a tumor marker that's used to aid in the diagnosis, but is not diagnostic of the malignancy, that we also utilize in screening for that cancer. Here in Shreveport, we have an aggressive hepatobiliary tumor service surgeons who are experts in transplantation techniques for the liver, and management of those patients is frequently presented at a tumor board that we've developed here in Shreveport at the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. This tumor board is specially convened to address hepatobiliary diseases, those that are, you know, typically very difficult to treat. And at this meeting, we present cases in front of surgeons, GI physicians, pathologists, interventional radiologists, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, in order to deliberate and formulate definitive treatment plans for patients. And the benefit of this is that we save a lot of time. In this respect, patients do not need to see or make 4 or 5 different clinic appointments in order to get a disposition on what's the best management for their disease. And we pride ourselves in that and being able to do that here in Shreveport. As far as chemotherapy advances for hepatobiliary diseases, we still have a long way to go. As far as targeted therapy, we still have very, very few options relative to other disease processes and the available options as far as targeted treatment. There are a lot of ongoing studies utilizing known treatments that are frequently employed in maybe the management of renal cell carcinoma and others of the like.
Okay, thank you very much. As we know, breast cancer is very, very popular in terms of fundraising, and diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer has advanced significantly over the past 20 years. But the most common cause of cancer death, and most commonly, is lung cancer in men and women. And what we've recently learned is that in high-risk populations, a CAT scan, a high-resolution CAT scan, is recommended for those who are at high risk. Do you find that will be successful in eliminating lung cancer, at least lowering the incidence of high progression states at diagnosis?
I think the benefit of that is that it is sub-selected a population of patients that should be at higher risk for developing a lung cancer. And I briefly read that study, and I believe it's older population patients, maybe is it 65 and older, mm-hmm. as well as patients that have had a 20-pack year history of tobacco abuse. Or is it 30? I'm sorry, 30-pack year history of tobacco abuse. So significant tobacco abuse history. And I do hope that that will confer an earlier diagnosis, treatment, and potential cure for those patients. As far as whether or not it's going to play out as well as the colonoscopy did for colon cancer, I think it's still too early to say.
And we know that, you know, actually colonoscopy is still underutilized. We could be catching a lot more colon cancers much earlier. And so to our listeners out there, many who may know someone who has a 30-pack year history of smoking, which means that you've smoked at least a pack of cigarettes per day for the past 30 years, or that could be two packs of cigarettes per day for the past 15 years,
correct.
Or three packs of cigarettes per day for the past 10 years. Do you recommend that those people, whether or not they have any symptomatic lung disease, visit their primary care physician and talk to them about this test?
Based on these new guidelines, I do. And, you know, given the results of that study, that CT scan will be, quote-unquote, paid for.
Absolutely.
By their insurance.
Right. I think that's important.
And, yes, as you mentioned, colonoscopy is still very underutilized, surprisingly, in this day and age. I had to counsel patients and family members today of patients who have colon cancer to go and get screened. It's unfortunate because it's such a simple test. I agree, the day before is probably not very pleasant, but the test itself is simple, and it could be a life-saving procedure.
What are the current recommendations for patients who have an average risk of colon cancer and then maybe patients who have an elevated risk of colon cancer, for example, a patient who may have a first-degree relative who has had colon cancer, or perhaps a patient who has a colon disease such as ulcerative colitis?
I believe that for people with general average risk, I believe the age of recommendation to begin colonoscopy screening is 50. With other risk factors, I think we can consider 40 to be the age to begin screening colonoscopies. As I mentioned before, I believe insurance companies are going to battle some of these recommendations still.
Dr. Black, I understand that there are significant advances in the surgical approach to ovarian cancer. You and I were discussing this recently. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy being given to patients preoperatively for ovarian cancer. How does that work?
So basically, when women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, unfortunately, this is usually at an advanced stage. It's usually at what we call stage 3C. So at that point, the cancer has already spread inside the abdominal cavity. And to try to fight this cancer, there's two very important steps. The first is you need a very aggressive surgery, and the goal of that surgery is to remove all of the tumor. And then the second part of the treatment is very intense chemotherapy. And more recently, the recommendation has changed to not only include chemotherapy that we administer into the patient's vein, but also to actually bathe the abdominal cavity with chemotherapy. So at the time of the initial surgery, we'll put an intraperitoneal catheter. So we'll actually put a catheter into the abdomen and leave it there at the time of surgery. And then when the patient has healed from surgery, we'll start the second phase of treatment, which is the chemotherapy, and they'll receive chemo in the vein as well as into the peritoneal cavity. And the studies have shown that with this mode of treatment, women actually will have a longer expected survival. So they expect them to live longer. Although it is more intense chemo, the patients do experience more side effects with this treatment. It seems to be better suited for the younger patient population in terms of them being able to actually tolerate the chemotherapy.
And in terms of the operative process, I understand we have a variety of approaches to a tumor operatively. We can open the body, look at the tumor directly. We can insufflate the abdomen with gas and look at the tumor laparoscopically. And I understand there's robotic surgery that's available now. What do these actually look like in terms of what tumors are approached and in which manner?
Well, in the field of GYN oncology, the two main cancers that we approach with the robot are usually endometrial cancer and cervical cancer. The studies for ovarian cancer, there's not as much, there aren't great studies on this. And the reason for that is because at the time of diagnosis for ovarian cancer, it's very extensive. And this is not a procedure that can be performed through small incisions, which you require for a robotic approach. But in terms of treatment for endometrial cancer and cervical cancer, using the robot has really been a great benefit for many women. It allows them to have a very quick recovery. They end up staying in the hospital a lot less, lot shorter stays in the hospital, and they end up getting back to their normal self a lot quicker. Because basically what you do is you make a tiny incision and place the camera in, and then you fill up the abdomen with gas, and then you usually put about three other small incisions and are able to place your instruments through those incisions to perform your procedure.
It sounds very effective in terms of being able to operate on endometrial cancer and cervical cancer. What cancers do you see in the future that would be amenable to a robotic approach and thus improved hospital stays and recovery?
Well, and it's actually being, the robot is being utilized in pretty much all the surgical fields now. Most commonly, though, we see it in urology and gynecology. And general surgery has used it quite a bit. And actually, colorectal cancers now are also starting to really embrace the robot.
Thank you very much. We have a question over the internet. When someone is diagnosed with cervical precancerous cells, usually they say it develops into cancer slowly, is what the person is asking. How long is the average, and how effective is the LEAP procedure? And perhaps you can tell us what the LEAP procedure is as well.
Okay, well, it does develop very slow, and it really depends on what stage of precancer the patient has. The very mild precancerous lesions, what we call mild dysplasia, those patients, many times you don't treat. You watch them and follow them, because with time, their actual immune system will take care of the virus, and they will go back to normal without any treatment. If the patient develops a moderate or severe level of dysplasia, then we usually treat that type of that problem. And the treatment that we offer, there's several different types. There's a cold knife conization. Sometimes we'll use laser therapy. Also, the LEAP procedure is a great option. The good thing about the LEAP procedure, basically what it is you have a loop type device, and you can do this in your office, and you actually, with this loop, are able to remove the abnormal cells on the cervix. You can visualize them and you can remove them, and it's actually very effective. The important thing to know is after you've had a procedure like this, you need to continue with follow-up with your physician. And typically what we will do is we will repeat a pap smear and as well as the human papillomavirus test, usually in 12 months after your procedure.
So once these cancerous cells are removed by the loop, the virus still exists in the cervix, presumably.
The precancerous cells.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the patient still needs to be monitored for the subsequent development of abnormal cells because the virus did not clear as it does in most people?
The actual procedure removes the abnormal tissue, but you could still harbor the virus. And so what we recommend now is we're actually doing more co-testing where you actually check the virus and the pap smear. And we actually do that at 12 months and 24 months after the procedure. And if either one of those are abnormal, then we perform a more in-depth test, which we call colposcopy, where we look at that cervix and visualize it and look for any new abnormalities.
How effective is the LOOP procedure and other similar procedures in actually removing the virus, which would mean a negative HPV test on their follow-up?
Well, the LEAP procedure and the laser procedure, they're not actually going to treat the virus itself. They're just going to treat the abnormalities on the cervix that are caused by the virus.
So once it's developed, the patients definitely need to have ongoing surveillance.
Absolutely. And the one thing people can do to lower their risk of keeping this virus is to quit smoking. that's actually a modifiable risk. Cigarette smoking puts you at a higher risk for having problems with cervical cancer as well as precancerous lesions.
Well, it's very important. It adds another cancer to the list of problems that develop with cigarette smoking. I understand colon cancer as well as renal cancer also has an increased risk with cigarette smoking as well. Over the past several years, we have seen prostate cancer mortality as well as diagnosis drop as well. One thing I've noticed in particular in the literature is the screening for prostate cancer. Dr. Velavalu, what is your opinion of the controversy regarding the screening for prostate cancer?
That's a good question, Dr. Brewer.
Perhaps you could tell us what the PSA is and tell us a little bit about how does prostate cancer develop and when is it something that needs to actually be treated and monitored more frequently.
There has been a lot of controversy in the literature about screening and the effectiveness of the PSA over the last several years, especially with the Urologic Oncologic Society. So they are going to there's going to be a lot of debate for that, and I don't know that they have an answer to date. The PSA is a blood test that tests for a protein that is theoretically produced by the prostate cancer cell, a cell that's mutated and will not undergo programmed cell death or apoptosis and die, and it continues to replicate and divide, making more and more of these abnormal cells, eventually forming a tumor. Theoretically, the PSA, once elevated, or actually the way we evaluate this is based on change, PSA change, PSA rise or doubling time, and a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. The PSA in and of itself is not diagnostic of prostate cancer. The recommendation is also have this checked at age 50. I think the controversy comes as a patient ages and whether or not it is effective in making a difference in survival. If we watch, evaluate, check the PSA, and treat the cancer. However, as far as treatment for prostate cancer, there have been many advances in the last 9 years with an advent of a chemotherapy that was discovered in 2005 in a study that has prolonged survival with prostate cancer, which has not been proven in years to date. There have been many chemotherapies effective in treating the symptoms of prostate cancer, but not in prolonging overall survival. As of late, we have new therapies in managing prostate cancer that are administered orally. And the major mechanism of action of these medications is based on discovery that the prostate cancer cells themselves can produce hormone, testosterone, the male hormone, that's required to, if you will, feed the prostate cancer. Historically, it's been thought that the source of the production of testosterone was predominantly due to the testicles and the adrenal glands, and we modulated that by administering such injections like the Lupron injection to block the production of the male steroid hormone. And once patients have failed to respond to that treatment, they are deemed androgen independent or refractory. However, another mechanism for treatment of these patients in advanced prostate cancer is by the utilization of these newer medications that theoretically inhibit the production of the steroid hormone in the prostate cancer themselves. Another very fascinating advance in prostate cancer that I feel like will be studied in other cancers as well is utilizing the body's own immune system to attack its own cancer. And this is done by harvesting the white blood cells from a patient and sending these blood cells to specialized laboratories, for which now we have access here in Shreveport via a direct flight to Atlanta, where a laboratory was established. And they attach a prostate cancer antigen to that white blood cell, send it back to us here in Shreveport, and we reinfuse that into the patient, thereby stimulating that patient's immune system to recognize, identify, and attack its own prostate cancer.
You know, along the same lines, we have a question over the internet. You know, what causes a cell to turn into a cancer cell?
It's a mutation. a mutation that has to occur in a specific location in that cell's DNA in order to turn off what's called programmed cell death or apoptosis.
And so cells
normally
die.
And it's not one mutation. It can be hundreds of mutations. For example, in lung cancer, there's no one mutation identified. It's hundreds. That's what makes cancer so difficult to treat. If it were one simple mutation, we could target it, identify it, target it, and treat it, and potentially cure the disease. But it's not that simple, unfortunately.
Yeah, another controversy or topic in the press has actually been the breast cancer gene. And should women who are at high risk for breast cancer, those who have a first-degree relative and have the breast cancer gene, should they have that test? And how many breast cancers, are a result of a mutation of that gene? And how should we deal with that?
I can speak to that a little bit. It's gotten a lot of press, particularly with some celebrities who tested positive for the gene. And it's actually, sometimes a lot of attention can generate increased amount of fear and misinformation. The genetic test does not guarantee that you will develop breast cancer or ovarian cancer, which it's also associated with, but it does suggest that you're at an increased risk of developing breast cancer. And the vast majority of breast cancers, however, are not related to these specific genes, the BRCA1 and BRCA2. These still represent just a very small percentage of breast cancers in the low single digits. In those high-risk populations, however, there can be an advantage to before one potentially could develop breast cancer, having their breasts removed surgically, and even possibly having their ovaries removed as well, since ovarian cancer could develop increasingly in this population. However, the vast majority of people do not harbor these genetic mutations and can oftentimes have much more conservative treatment. So they can have a lumpectomy and radiation and preserve the breast and not really benefit from having a mastectomy or, for that matter, having both breasts removed. In recent years, with the increasing attention on genetic-based breast cancer, there's been a sharp increase in the number of people who are having both breasts removed following the diagnosis of breast cancer in one breast. But in the population that is negative for the genetic marker, the BRCA1 and 2, there is no survival advantage. People do not live any longer. They do not. They certainly do not increase their risk of cure by having one or for that matter, both breasts removed. And so it's kind of the pendulum has swung. It's actually led to a lot of over-treatment. Aggressive over-treatment, and particularly when you're talking about breast cancer, we want to be careful not to over-treat. On the one hand, we make that same argument on prostate cancer, whether we should screen for prostate cancer in older men, because after all, for some of these men, they may have a lot of other health problems. They may have heart disease and other issues and have a limited life expectancy. And since prostate cancer grows so slowly, treating it may not actually translate into any great benefit and may be associated with all sorts of side effects. So, that debate is certainly being argued, but we've kind of gone in the other direction with breast cancer, and that is where, many times we're being overly aggressive. So, these genetic tests, they're tools, and they really need to be interpreted with medical professionals.
Yeah, you mentioned prostate cancer, and the American Cancer Society recommends that men who have a PSA test have a life expectancy of at least 10 years to even have the test administered.
Yes.
We have another question over the Internet. Are there any herbal supplements that can be taken to reduce the risk of cancer, or any other home treatments? Or are there home treatments that can be done in tandem with radiation treatments?
Yeah. So, there's been a lot of interest in some of these supplements, lycopene being the one that comes to mind. But I don't think the actual critical investigation of lycopene really panned out to be that beneficial. You know, all of these advances, the medicines in particular that Dr. Vellavalu referred to, and even the surgical procedures and the radiation procedures, they're subject to rigorous evaluation, controlled clinical trials, blinded so that the people investigating these treatments don't know what they're necessarily the patients are getting. The patients don't know what they're getting. And then statistics, careful statistical analysis is done to really see if there's a benefit or not. The problem with the herbal supplements is that they're not critically reviewed. They're not generally critically studied using the scientific method, and so most of their benefit is anecdotal, and it's through individual case reports. And so while that's certainly very appealing, it's not really good science. There is another issue though that's important is that these herbal supplements are not necessarily benign, and many of them can have active ingredients that may not even be listed, and they could come from other places, and sometimes they can actually interact with the treatments that the patient is getting, whether it be radiation or chemotherapy. And so I'm oftentimes a little nervous about them, and so it's very important if you are going to use them that you notify your clinician about it.
Thank you very much. We have a caller, and please remember to call us at 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. We're discussing cancer diagnosis and treatment. Our expert guests tonight are Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center, Dr. Anil Vellavalu, medical oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center, and Dr. Destin Black, gynecologic oncologist with LSU University Health, as well as the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Mike from Shreveport, what's your question?
Yes, I've got a question about pancreatic cancer. Since it's usually found late, what are some of the early symptoms people should pay attention to?
That's a great question, Mike. Typically patients present with pain in the abdomen, difficulty eating, getting full earlier, weight loss, and if the cancer is relatively advanced, even locally, meaning at where it has started, people can present with jaundice. Any questions if you have a family history of this disease or have a history of alcohol abuse or tobacco abuse, as Dr. Brewer had alluded to earlier, gallstone, pancreatitis in the past, or any types of pancreatitis in the past with these type of symptoms, you should follow up with your primary care physician for further evaluation.
I believe alcohol may be a cause as well, or have some link to pancreatic cancer. We have another caller who asks, is alcohol a direct cause of cancer, or is it something that has to be sort of in the milieu to induce a cell to turn into a cancer cell?
I think what happens is alcohol is not a direct causal agent for cancer in the sense that it's not it's causing the cells to actually undergo changes that predispose them for malignancy or transformation into malignancy. We see this in head and neck cancer, esophageal cancer, and gastric cancer, particularly in pancreatic cancer.
And breast cancer
being the major diseases that we think of when we have a significant alcohol history in a patient that's presented to us.
Thank you very much. Again, our number is 1-800-552-8502. We are on Health Matters. We welcome your calls. We are discussing cancer diagnosis and treatment and updates. We mentioned lifestyles. What lifestyle changes should one make if they have issues with alcoholism, tobacco use, and particularly dietary habits in terms of reducing risks for cancer?
Obviously, as you mentioned, Dr. Brewer, alcohol should be consumed in moderation. Moderation to some people is different to moderation in other people. But it should be limited to maybe one drink a day, one glass of wine, one mixed drink a day. Tobacco should be cut out completely. There have been, absolutely, completely. And there have been studies that have now directly linked obesity with the development of many different cancers. And unfortunately, since I have graduated, that has become more prominent. So I have had to incorporate that into my practice and counseling my patients to lose weight, because when I started, it was nice that I didn't have to fuss at anybody about their weight. But unfortunately, now we really need to have serious discussions with people about appropriate weight loss and dietary habits. Not a diet, but a way of life, a way of eating that can be maintained throughout life. In my opinion, a diet implies a temporary act or behavior that can be reversed later once a theoretical goal is achieved. That would be my recommendation.
What specific dietary habits are important?
Oh, you're asking the wrong person. Typically, you don't want diets high in fat and high in useless or unnecessary carbohydrates. Fruits and vegetables obviously are high in antioxidants when you're talking about our disease process. Low in red meat, high in fish. Those would be typical recommendations.
So more plants and less animals.
There you go. Like.
We have another caller, Mike from Lafayette. Mike, what's your question?
Yeah, you mentioned the 30-pack year threshold or a point for smokers, and you mentioned something about insurance and getting the CAT scan as a early diagnosis tool. Do most insurance companies pay for that? And if not, what would a ballpark range cost for to have one of those scans?
Dr. Katz, what does a CAT scan cost for lung cancer surveillance?
The lung cancer screening CT scans can cost upward of just over a little over $1,000, but that's changing now, because if you, let's say you're uninsured or you don't have coverage that would pay for it, there's probably a little bit more room for negotiation up front if you're going to an imaging center or a hospital and you're having to pay. Many times they will work out an arrangement whereby if you pay up front, they may give you a discount. It really varies from facility to facility what they charge. A facility can charge whatever they want, and then they have negotiated rates with whether it be the government or with insurance companies. And so what they actually get paid may be different than what they actually charge, and sometimes it could be magnitudes of difference. So, there can be some wiggle room if you go and you ask, what does this cost? Well, what are they willing to accept?
Okay, thank you for your answer. And as we know, as one continues to smoke, the risk of lung cancer continues to elevate. Although, if you stop smoking, the risk is still there. So if someone had stopped smoking, let's say, 5 years or 10 years ago, they should also consider surveillance if that proves to be recommended.
Right. And one key thing about surveillance, and Dr. Burr, you were talking about the various cancers that we've done well with and the ones that we haven't done well with. Lung cancer, unfortunately, is one that we've made very little progress on over the last 10, 20 years. The problem with lung cancer is that it's generally rather advanced at the time of diagnosis because people don't have symptoms. And so really the best chance we have at treating lung cancer is catching it early. And then the cure rates can be, pretty high. So anyway, that would definitely be worthwhile.
Yeah, like ovarian, pancreatic, I believe lung cancer tends to be fairly advanced before it's symptomatic. Gina from Shreveport, what's your question?
Yes, I'm in remission from stomach cancer. I'm 58 years old. On my father's side of the family, my second cousin just got diagnosed. She's 50 years old with stage 3 stomach cancer. I also have a cousin, male in his 70s, diagnosed with stomach cancer as well. Should my family be checked for the stomach cancer gene?
Can I ask you?
This is Dr. Volovalu.
Yes. You said you had a cousin, and then, I'm sorry, what was the other relative?
He was diagnosed in his 70s also with stomach cancer. Myself, I was diagnosed at age 55 with stage 2 stomach cancer.
Are these other two relatives on the same side of the family?
Correct.
Do you have any Oriental descent in your heritage?
I'm half Nicaraguan, not Oriental.
Okay. There is a particular gene mutation that we have known to cause a familial gastric cancer in Southeast Asians. I do quite a bit of gastric cancer, and I've yet to identify this gene. I'm not sure that you would qualify for that analysis, but I would, given your family history, recommend that your family members are hypervigilant about any symptoms and possibly asking or requesting or discussing with their primary care physician endoscopic surveillance with scopes to at least visualize at a baseline what their esophagus and stomach looks like. Now, once again, that's not going to follow any strict guideline. Every case has to be evaluated individually. But that would be a definite discussion I would recommend your family members have with their primary care physician, given that history.
Gina, we certainly appreciate your call, and we wish you the best with your recovery and that of your family members as well. Dr. Volovlu, what are the modifiable risk factors that we could consider in gastric cancer? I think we've mentioned smoking and ethanol. Are there other modifiable risk factors?
Those are. Probably diet would be another significant concern as far as a risk factor associated with gastric cancer. This disease, unfortunately, is endemic in Japan, of all places. And Japan is a culture that has a significant portion of their diet consists of smoked fish. And that smoking of that food or barbecuing or whatnot, however you want to look at it, is a significant risk factor to the development of gastric carcinoma, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for that insight. The other cancer that other group of cancers that we hear quite a bit about now in the news with regards to gene therapy are the leukemias and the lymphomas. Can you speak a little bit about the updates in chemotherapy targeted and genetic for the hematologic malignancies, briefly?
We could speak all night on this. This population, just in general, of patients, the treatment options for them have exploded in the last 5 years. This is due to discovery of different second messengers, different targets within the leukemia cells. It's endless, and it is exciting. Monoclonal antibodies, particularly of interest in treating these diseases, and the beauty of which is in many of these treatments, the side effect profile is much better than what we've known in the past with typical chemotherapy, per se.
Thank you very much, and we encourage you to surf the internet if you're interested in more answers about cancer in general. The American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute have excellent websites, and they are excellent resources for patients and physicians as well. I would like to thank our guests tonight, Dr. Sanford Katz, Dr. Anil Velovalu, and Dr. Destin Black. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult your physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Tonight's program was engineered by Kermit Poling with production assistance from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randy Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.